Welcome to The Hours. I am Mark. I'm joined by my friend Tyler. We are going to spend some time with you today. We're excited to have you. Thank you for listening to the podcast. We are continuing to get really good feedback from the podcast. And I'm going to issue a challenge to all the listeners today. The first time you hear something that's noteworthy, stop and share the podcast with your coaching friend, or reach out to us and tell us what was noteworthy about the podcast. A lot of people reach out through email or DMs through our community and tell us what struck a chord with them in the podcast. It's always good feedback for us because we can spend more time on that. That is what The Hours are for. We get into the stuff that we believe good coaches should know. Tyler, welcome. What's new?
Thank you. Good coaches should know that about 5% of their total net worth should be invested in the digital asset Bitcoin. Pause the podcast now and share it. If that's the only piece of information, really do it. You know, I'm not a financial advisor, but this is financial advice.
But you should be.
You should be 5%.
I was going to say, I think I'm well invested and diversified, but I'm apparently not because I'm not in the digital coin space yet.
Absolutely not. One of the best pieces of financial advice that I got from my financial mentor was once a year, you should first just on a piece of paper, put down the percent of your total net worth that you would like invested in each space, whether it be like real estate, stocks and bonds, digital assets, gold, business, whatever. Put it down, this is my ideal percentage, and then actually do an audit on your total net worth and see how far off you are. Every person I've ever done that exercise with has been significantly off, and it's an opportunity to rebalance. I mean, you would do an audit like that on your basketball program. Why not do it on your personal finances? It's a very simple way. Measurement is magic. And when you measure it, it improves.
Agreed.
All right. We'll maybe do a little, we'll do a little bonus hours if, and I can talk through the five-step process to diversify into digital currencies and digital assets and the best place to hold those if we would like.
Sounds like a teach better segment.
Sounds like a teach better segment.
All right, Tyler, what's the big question?
Oh yeah, sorry. It's my turn. My mind was racing on MicroStrategy leveraged leveraged options. All right, here's the big question today, Mark. I will ask it of you. What is something that a coach has to relearn every season? What are common blind spots that a coach must relearn every year as we head into the thick of this year's basketball season?
Yeah, I find this is the time where we start to relearn it, is when you get into basketball practice. And I think there's a lot of things that we have to relearn as coaches every year. I'll give you two, and they're kind of related. One, your team is never tough enough or as tough as they could be. In my experience, and in my coaching experience and in my consulting experience, I've come across many programs that start the season. And after the first scrimmage jamboree, the head coach is saying, we don't rebound hard enough. We're not physical enough. We don't go after loose balls hard enough. We're responding to the officials too much. We made subs and we didn't respond to standard, right? We were below standard on how we either came off the court, what our timeouts looked like, our behavior when we got subbed out of the games. And my recommendation is obviously focus on that first. If the blind spot is we're not playing hard enough, we have to play harder. We have to play tougher. Then shouldn't we just start there and fill in the blanks? I find too often we go the opposite in that, and everything is so technical. We're installing our offense. We're getting set plays, our under out of bounds stuff. And then, oh my gosh, we play our first game and we're not tough enough yet. So the relation to that, I said I'd give you two things. I think as a head, that's kind of more team driven. I think as a head coach, something that we have to learn every year is to embrace challenges instead of avoid them. Adversity strengthens. So playing time or parent situations, administrative issues with the administration, managing people, it's all really, really difficult. And I feel sometimes we think, oh, this is a new year, we're not going to have those problems. But I mean, tell me a coach that doesn't have playing time problems every year or a parent problem in some way or another every year.
That's good. I'm just taking notes here. It's so good. Okay. All right. How do you fix it? So if this is the blind spot, this is what a coach has to relearn every single year. How does a coach fix it? How do they go into the season and to address it in advance before it hurts?
Yeah, I mean, I think just in coaching is intentional observation. So what are you saying? What are we not doing? Don't assume that because we play a game that we're going to be tough or we're going to rebound. Be careful of the lens in which you're watching your team through. If we don't have a coach dedicated to rebounding, maybe you have a toughness coach, right? And maybe that's rebounding, physicality, loose balls. But also, how can we incorporate that into everything that we do? This would be just one example of how we would just incorporate some kind of toughness every single day. If we're going to play one-on-one, let's start with a blockout. Whoever gets the rebound gets to play offense. And if Tyler and I go three reps and he beats me to the rebound all three times, well, I got to play defense all three times. He gets to play offense all three times. Or coach throw a ball out and we got to run it down. How hard do we relentlessly pursue that ball with two hands and grab it instead of dribbling it to ourselves? If I get it, I get to play offense. If you don't, you play defense. And I think that's a way you just bake in toughness every single practice, every game, every drill. But also, I think, too, just being intentional about, one, we're going to play hard and we're going to be a really tough team. And then secondary, we're going to execute everything else.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Let me take a shot at this. And I hope that this can provide some very clean, actual steps, because this can remove a lot of pain for coaches this season. Here's the problem. The problem with having to relearn this every single year is you spend too much time on the wrong things in preseason and the beginning of your season. What are the wrong things? They're not bad things. The wrong things that Mark already illustrated are your system, your X's and O's, all of, you know, how you're going to play on the court. That's 90% of the mental space that you are in right now as a coach. Whereas what we're suggesting is the problem, the blind spot is you're focusing on that and not focusing on what I'm going to call your standards and your culture. Whereas that's going to be what you run into within the first 2 weeks of your season. When you're together, you're going to run into an, oh crap, we need to establish standards, and our culture is not as healthy as we need it to be. That is the problem. The solution is this: flip your preparation. Flip your preparation percentage from the majority of it being around your systems and your X's and O's, and flip your preparation to your standards and your culture. So how do you actually do this? We've used these words before, but I believe that this may be the first time that you're interacting with Savvy, or you need to hear it again, because I need to hear it again. And I've been interacting with this for 10 years. I'm going to flip this into two buckets. And the bucket I'm going to name is standards and culture, right? Culture has gotten a lot of focus. We focus more on standards here because standards are inputs and culture is outputs. Standards are your process and the culture is the outcome of your standards. So how do you establish standards? I believe there's three steps to establishing your standards. We've shared this before. I'll share it again. Standards are vision, values, and standards, right? That's the process of which you arrive at standards, okay? Culture is measurement, process, and culture. Culture is the outcome of your standards. So vision, where are we going and what type of program do we want to run? That's a vision that's cast by a leader, by a visionary. You are the leader. You are the visionary of your program. You cast a vision. Values are shared things that we think are important. It's valuable. It's important. So we establish, okay, these shared values, it's important to show up on time because a program that's going to achieve this grand vision has to show up on time or show up early, whatever the values are. The standards are the definition of what is above the standard, in line with the standard, below the standard. Mark, you've done a wonderful job of teaching me that over the past year. So once you can create and spend this preparation time on your vision, your values, and then the standards, now you can begin to shift into culture. But culture doesn't just magically arrive, you know, like, oh, we have a good culture, we have a bad culture. It doesn't happen by accident. It only happens by doing the standards work in advance. So once you've done your standards work in advance, you've defined it, and then Mark, I'll ask you to respond and clean me up here. And then, okay, we actually have to do the work of measuring the, are we below, at or above the standard. We have to do the work to measure it. It requires focus, it requires time. And we have to establish processes to actually improve our scores, right? Scores or the measurement against the standards don't improve on their own. What processes do you have by which you're going to improve it? You know, people do that with a points board. People do that with one-on-one coaching conversations. People do that with ladders. People do that with all sorts of different things, right? But you have to have some measurement because measurement is magic. You have to measure yourself against your standards regularly. Finally, ownership. Once you've established these processes, then you want to share ownership of these processes. Assistant coach, you own this process. Team captain, you own this process. Senior, you own this process. Freshman, you own this process. You have to give ownership of the processes to other people. And once the process is owned by the team, you have a culture. And so that whole process that I just shared takes time, energy, preparation, and execution. And you have a limited amount of those things. And so what Mark is suggesting to us here is every year we as a coach have to relearn that we need to spend more time on our standards and culture in the preseason, because we often spend too little time on that and too much time on our systems.
Yeah, really well said. What struck a chord with me is you said in advance is when we do this stuff, right? We're preparing for the season. We got to be proactive with these things. I find, you know, you have culture, whether you're intentionally building it or not, because culture is how people behave. I've also thought of this. Culture seems to be this like really long-term thing or this like, I don't know, something that's like, it's just there and it lives there. I think culture is actually shorter term than people give it credit for. I think you can start changing or change your culture in like 30 to 60 days, because it's kind of like a what have you done lately. You know, culture is not just something that you have and possess. Your culture really changes. There's some times in the year where everything's going great. Well, your culture is probably gonna be really good. There's other times when things are not going well. If your culture is really up and down, that means your culture is not strong enough, because where I think you see culture is actually in adversity. Everybody can be above standard when things are good. How are we going to respond when we do hit the adversity? How are you going to respond as a coach when your team doesn't play hard, or a player is below standard, or your team's having a bad practice? If one of your values is being resilient, and the second you hit adversity as a head coach, you start yelling and screaming, well, you really don't have that culture, right? Because you can't give away what you don't possess. So if I'm not resilient as a head coach, I can't give that to my players and to my culture. So don't wait for something to go wrong before you establish a standard around it, or don't assume there's going to be some type of standard because you're a coach and you're part of a team. If your players respond, you know, you go into your first scrimmage, your players respond negatively when they're pulled out of the game, and then now we get upset. And then the next day it's like, hey, we've got to address what it's like when we sub, right? That's below standard. Well, that should have been done way before. You know, you're going to sub a player out. So why not be proactive with it? So really, really good. I think there's a lot of things that coaches need to learn every year, but just, you could solve a lot of it by casting that vision, having values, and then creating standards around that.
I'm debating whether or not it's valuable to share these examples or anecdotes of the red bike, of the don't. I don't know if it's valuable or not yet, but it's funny. So I'll go ahead and share. I was at a coaching clinic this last weekend. I was listening to another breakout session roundtable with a college coach that was presenting, and they were talking. One of their main sections was about establishing culture, and they shared their, I'm going to call them punishments intentionally. They shared their punishments when players do things that are outside of their standards. And that lit up the room of high school coaches. They got excited about these punishments. And so one high school coach shared, oh yeah, when we don't box out, we have to run a set of sprints while singing the theme song to Frozen. He's like, that's just the culture of our program. And then that just let loose, like every coach feeling like they wanted to share their most creative punishment when there's behavior that they don't like. And it's just interesting that it was eye-opening for me to hear that that's what a large section of coaches in the state of Michigan associate with culture. Culture is what creative punishments can we come up with when we don't like a behavior. And so why do I share that? Not so that you go and make your players run while singing the theme song to Elsa, which usually probably leads to shame and embarrassment, which are poor motivators in the long term. But rather, that's an example of reactive culture versus proactive culture, right? I don't like this behavior, right? And so I'm going to communicate that to you by punishing you in a reactive way because I got surprised by this activity. Proactive would be clearly defining your vision, values, and standards, establishing measurements and processes by which you want to strengthen those measurements so that no one's surprised when all of a sudden in practice they're running up and down the court screaming the theme song to Frozen. That is what we're offering up.
Yeah, I think that's very close or in line of definition of transactional coaching, right? Like you're not doing something that I want you to do. So you got to run and sing Anna and Elsa, or maybe a Kristoff song. I think that
maybe,
was
maybe. Gosh, that's a good Disney reference right there.
But running and singing Frozen songs, it doesn't develop character. It doesn't strengthen the relationship. It doesn't encourage buy-in. In fact, it does the opposite of that. So it's you did this, so I'm going to do this to you. Now we're even. I know I've said that on the podcast, but man, that is my coaching pet peeve because a month from now, your players aren't going to play really hard because they had to sing Anna and Elsa at practice. They're going to play really hard because they're bought in and they're intrinsically motivated because they are part of the culture that's been created.
Mark, why do you think that lights coaches up so much? I mean, I was just at the back of the room and the moment that was shared, everyone like lit up. They were like elbowing the coach next to them, like saying, oh yeah, like here's what we do. And they all wanted to share what they do. Why does that light coaches up so much? I'm trying to understand from a human motivation psychology standpoint, why does that light people up?
Light people up like the punishment you're saying?
Yeah. Like as soon as they started talking punishments, like that was like the most engagement the entire presentation got.
Yeah. I don't know if I have a specific answer here. I just think it's the way that coaches think you coach. Somebody doesn't do what they want, so we punish them and then they'll be more likely to do what we want them to do. I feel like that's probably the way we were coached. That's the way most coaches coach. So they think it's effective coaching. You see it all the time on social media, a coach yelling, screaming, and then there's just, if you look at the comments, it's just never ending battle of some coaches saying that that's ineffective coaching, and then other coaches saying that that is good coaching. And, you know, again, I think if you can coach people hard if the intent is to make them a better person. If that's not the intent, I think Nick Saban said something about this just recently. He was saying like just yelling and screaming to yell and scream is not coaching at all, right? Coaching, the word coach was derived from taking someone from one place to another, right? So a good coach.
Like you ride in a coach. Okay. Yes. Or carriage. Yeah.
Yeah. So a good coach takes someone where they can't go themselves. And here's another thing. I don't know where in coaching we got to a place where we feel like we had to make someone feel bad before they did something right. It's like, you made a mistake, so let me make you feel bad about it, and then we'll correct it. How about just be more solution-based? Yeah.
Okay. No, that's good. And I love the coach vocabulary lesson there. That's excellent. Okay, here, let me offer up my thought on this, and then we can move off the big question for the day. And our goal in this exploration is we hope that as we explore coaching, coaches' motivation, our experience, both with having coached, coaching, and coaching coaches, that it can illuminate something in you and help you become a more savvy coach. Savvy is just smart. Like there's a smarter way to do things. There's always a smarter way to do things. We are on a lifelong search here at Savvy to find those smarter ways to do things, the more savvy way to do things. And so we hope to share it with you.
Yeah. And before we go further, I just want to say, we're not sitting here saying we have all the answers either. We're just here to help and share our experiences. We've seen and worked with coaches all across the country. We've spent our entire life trying to figure this out and learn new ways and teaching methods. And we're just sharing what we believe, but we're not here saying that we're perfect either.
Absolutely not. I'll offer this up. I actually believe that why coaches get so lit up or excited when they talk about providing consequences for poor behavior, I'm going to actually suggest, I think it does come from a really positive place. I think it really does come from a place of deep care. And they get lit up because they believe that those are the moments where they are teaching and influencing the behaviors that they care most about, which are culture pieces, which are standards pieces, effort, communication, showing up on time, all of the life lessons that coaches want to teach their players. They believe that those are the moments where they're really helping players. So I would say it's sourced from a really positive place. And that's why they get lit up. I just think we as coaches sometimes are a little misguided about the best way to help teach the things that we care most about. And if you take, in summary, if you take one thing away from this exploration of what's your blind spot, what's the thing you got to relearn year over year, is becoming proactive with teaching those things that you care most about, as opposed to reactive. Because when you're reactive, it becomes singing Frozen while running. And the lesson that you care most about teaching is probably missed, because all they'll remember is the singing and not why they had to sing.
Perfect. Yeah. If you're listening, now is the time you pause the podcast and send it to a coaching friend. That was really good.
And buy Bitcoin. So yes.
And buy Bitcoin.
All right. Actually, the best time to buy Bitcoin right now. Sorry, the best time to buy Bitcoin 10 years ago. The second best time to buy Bitcoin. Yes. Yes. I just had to throw that in. Yeah. Buy Bitcoin, plant a tree, and eat organic.
I do eat organic.
I do my best to eat organic. Is Cane's organic? Because that's my guilty pleasure. And whenever I'm really hungry out on the road, I'll go eat Cane's, and I don't think that's organic.
You know, Cane's was originated in Baton Rouge, actually.
I do know that. I do know that.
Baton Rouge is important because that's where I am. All right, Tyler, let's go to mailbag.
Let's go.
I'm going to throw the first one to you. What is an example of a game sandwich, and what is a skinny?
Beautiful. Game sandwich is a vocabulary term that we use here at Savvy to talk about a teaching progression. It's a progression from a game to a drill and back to a game. That's what a game sandwich is. And so an example of it would be 2-on-2. We're playing 2-on-2 lock on a side. We play a game. 2-on-2 lock on a side. You can find it in our drill book, whatever. It's a 2-on-2 small-sided game. Then we notice that our players are having a lot of trouble making good decisions while passing, because they're making rushed passes. So then we stop the game and we do a skinny. A skinny is a short period of time in a compressed space to try to improve some technique, read, whatever. And so what I found is a lot of times players that are making bad passes are making bad passes because they aren't taking time. And they're not taking time because they're under pressure. And so a better thing to do when they're under pressure is to actually pivot out of the pressure, as opposed to try to get rid of the ball. And so we do a skinny to work on pivoting out of pressure. So we work in a small group of three where one player has the ball. They're not allowed to dribble. There's a defender that's pressuring them. They have to pivot out of the pressure for 5 seconds while their teammate, he has to count to five while trying to move and find a window for the pass, and they can't pass till 5 seconds. So once they pass after 5 seconds, then they follow their pass and become the pressurer, whereas the defender becomes the teammate, and they're just playing a little monkey in the middle with a 5 second pivot, and they cannot pass before 5 seconds. We do that for a very skinny amount of time, 3 to 4 minutes. And then we go back to the same game, 2v2 lock on the side, where they have to get open on a blast on a wing. And the player with the basketball then gets to utilize, hopefully, that new feeling or that new physical skill in order to improve their performance in the game. That's a game sandwich using a skinny in the middle of it. Now, you could use a skinny in the middle of it, or if you want to do something in more time or with more space or with more teaching, you could actually do that. In fact, at its latest stage, while we don't suggest running 5-on-0, if one did want to use 5-on-0, you could use it in a game sandwich. I guess I'm giving another example. You could be playing 5-on-5, play the game, right? Oh, we're really having a lot of trouble shaping the floor on offense. We don't really understand what our big magnets on the floor are as we're introducing 5-out. So as part of our game sandwich in the middle of this game, we're going to stop. We're going to put the two teams to two ends, and we're actually going to have them go 5-on-0 to find out where these big, you know, magnets on the floor are for, right? So you could throw that in the middle, but we're going to immediately go back to the game. Now they understand where the spots are on the floor. They're going to shape the floor a little bit better, or we're going to work on how we exit cut in the middle, right? And then we go back and play the game again. That would be an example of a game sandwich. I suggest you at least do throw a little defense in there, but if not, if you're just getting introduced to game sandwiches, that's how you could transition from 5-on-0 first to, okay, let's shift a little bit away from that and let's throw it in the middle of a game as a game sandwich.
Yeah, really good. I'm going to actually ask myself a question that is in the mailbag, and I will relate it to a game sandwich and or skinny. So one question we had was, why don't coaches change? What are Savvy's thoughts on why coaches tend to see change, view change in a negative manner, or just resistant to change? Objects in motion tend to stay in motion. If you've been coaching this way for a long time, you're going to be resistant to change. So my advice, if you're resisting change, if you've come across something, whether it's Savvy or not, and it's challenging your thinking, that's a really good thing. The hard part is just starting. So I would say just start in one way. We would love for you to jump in the deep end, because we're here to help and we'll walk you through the process. But if you want to just dip your toe in the water, just dip your toe in the water. And here's how, with a game sandwich, or an example of how a game sandwich would apply. Think baseball. We've got first base, second base, third base, and home. Most coaches will coach in a linear process of, we have to do a drill before we play games, especially a whole practice. I've seen practices where it's an hour of drills. And then if we have time at the end, we'll play some 5-on-5. That's like, we're going to go to first base, then second base, then third base, and we'll finally get home and play games. I would encourage coaches, the way to start would be, don't start on first base. So Tyler mentioned 2-on-2. Most coaches would feel like they had to do the monkey in the middle or the pivot out of pressure drill or skinny before they played 2-on-2. I would challenge you, just jump right into the game. Play 2-on-2. Maybe your players are doing a really nice job of pivoting out of pressure. Well, then there's no reason why we have to do that drill before. But a security blanket or a backup plan for you would be, have your skinny, have your drill ready to go. So we're going to play this game. And if we're not pivoting out of pressure, we can go back to first base, do our skinny, then go back to the game and see if it transfers or help our players be more successful, less turnovers, whatever you want to say, in that game. So how do you start? Why are coaches resistant to change? One, they're uncomfortable. And we tend as humans to lean away from things that make us uncomfortable. So just start on second base instead of first base. If you're ever designing practice and you have a drill than a game, try to reverse that order. Let's jump right into the game. And we always have the drill in our back pocket if we need it.
Beautiful. Why don't coaches change? Because of their belief about change. Many human beings associate change with pain, change with discomfort. And so they're like, any change feels bad. But one of my favorite quotes is this: to improve is to change. To perfect is to change constantly. I'm going to say it again because it's become kind of like a core belief of mine. I think that it is a core belief of Savvy, is like, to improve is to change, and to perfect is to change constantly. Perfection is not an end state. Perfection is a mastery approach, is constantly changing. So that should influence our beliefs as a coach about change. Do we want to improve? Change. Do we want to approach perfection? Right? Well, we have to constantly change. So now once we have that belief system, we're actually looking for change as opposed to resisting change. And Mark already did a wonderful job of talking about how you practically would do that. But I think a limiting belief is going to off-ramp you before you can ever achieve the success that you want. You've got to remove limiting beliefs, right? I'm not a great shooter. I'm not a great communicator. I'm not a charismatic leader. I'm not a vision caster. I'm not funny. I'm not whatever. If you have that limiting belief, it's impossible to change. You have to update your belief in order to ever change.
Really good. All right, Tyler, I got a question for you. Revolves around lock left. Shocker. We always get questions around lock left, and good time for questions on lock left. Because
Tyler, let me ask you a question before we go about lock left. Because okay. I've noticed this as well. Thrilled with the response to our cohort this month. Thrilled with the webinar response. I mean, I got brought in to go speak at a coach's clinic just because people want to know about lock left. Okay, I'm thrilled with the response to lock left. Mark, you are newer to lock left than I am, obviously, but you're very plugged into it. And I really want your honest answer here. Why do people get so excited about lock left?
I think because it's new.
Why don't more people do it? I mean, because what percent of coaches in North America run lock left?
10.
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's higher than I actually was assuming. I don't know, but my perception would be like
2-1%. Okay.
But I don't know. Right. Like, I'm saying lock left. I'm saying like lock left, not like, oh yeah, we force weak. You know what I mean? But like lock left the system.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Like 1% then.
Maybe. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So yeah, because it seems like there's a much higher interest in it than adoption of it. So yeah. I was curious your perception on both of those things. I even ran into this weekend. It's like, oh yeah, I'm really interested in your presentation, right? Oh yeah, that was interesting. Are you going to do it? Probably not. You know, we don't have the personnel. Probably not. I'm a really good, you know, right? So it's curious to me that there is such a significant difference between the interest level and the adoption level.
Yeah, you know, I think it actually goes back to the previous question of change. The longer, as I said, objects in motion tend to stay in motion. The longer you've run your current defensive system, it's probably really difficult to get away from it. Whether I think if you're a newer coach and, hey, I've only been coaching for 2 years, and my first year we played zone, and this year we tried man, and I didn't like either one, or I think they can be better. All right, let me try lock left. Instead of the coach has been coaching for 20 years and plays, you know, right, pack line man for 20 years. It's just such a big change. I think the interest comes from it's new. Coaches love to be on the cutting edge of things. I think the slow to adopt would be they haven't done it yet. Most coaches want to see film of it being done successfully, which we do have. But I just think the fear of the unknown. But I don't know. I also think, this is probably the answer.
Okay.
Coaches try to take away everything, and they don't like the clarity and what lock left might give up.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Does that make sense?
No, that's actually a wonderful realization and share. That's huge. Yeah. It's so good. Coaches. Yeah. Oh yeah. I want to have a plan to take away everything, and lock left is probably the only defense that I've really been aware of that's honest in the fact that we can't. Well, this is a fun little, it's fun for me because it's a realization. I was installing it with this college team, right? And I was asking them questions to try to model asking questions. And I wish I could remember the exact scenario, but I asked them a question, but like, okay, where should you stand when the ball is here, right? And they said something, and I said, why? And they said, oh, because we have to take away, it was a mid-range. Yeah. It was a mid-range, right? He's like, oh, we have to try to contest the shot. I said, why? He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, what's the point of defense, right? And he said, stop them from scoring, right? And I said, oh, how's that working out for you? How many games have you done that? He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, how many games have you done that? He was so confused. He couldn't wrap his mind around. I'm like, how many games have you held the team to 0 points? And he's like, well, zero. I'm like, well, that would lead to a lot of frustration, don't you think? If your goal is to keep the other team from scoring, you're never successful with it, right? That's kind of stupid. I said, in the lock left, that's not our goal. And they were just like flabbergasted. I'm like, they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, it's not our goal to keep the team from scoring, right? we actually have really clear goals in the lock left, and it's not to keep them from scoring. And so like that mind shift, and being honest about that, you know, cause all, every coach, you know, has, well, what about this? Right. Well, if they do that, they're going to score, and let's go try to score a little more efficiently. Cause the goal is to win the game, right? The goal is not to hold them to zero. The goal is to win the game. And so I think that's true, that that whole mindset into saying, we're not going to address this at all, freaks coaches out, cause they want a tool to take away everything.
Yeah. We want to get good shots and more good shots than our opponent, right? I've heard that. I've also heard victory favors the team that makes the fewest mistakes. But never we hold our opponent scoreless, and that's how we win the game, right?
Never.
You know, every defense gives something up and takes something away. If you can live with what you're willing to give up and put on blinders to that, no matter what you run, your defense is going to be way more successful than trying to take away everything. I will give you, I'm going to give you two quick examples here. One, I was visiting with a high school coach who we consult for, and he was talking about skirmishing in the gap. And he said, you know, what's the timing on the skirmish? Because I feel like when we skirmish on the first bounce or when the ball cracks the shell, we're giving up too big of a gap. And I had to tell him, well, if that is what you're, you still have a wall defender, right? You have a low man, a goalie, a help defender, whatever you want to call it, who is the helper if needed. If you don't like a skirmish because you feel like that's creating a gap, then you should probably just help one pass away and live with giving up sevens. So it was just a good reminder of, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The goal of a skirmish is actually not to stop the ball. It's to slow the ball down, cause indecision, the illusion of help, to shrink that gap momentarily. And then another example is this. I was working with a college team. They were running a 2-3 zone that was giving up dribble in mid-range twos. And they were actually really successful running this 2-3 zone defense. And then they started making tweaks to take away that mid-range two. And then they got to a point where they didn't know how they were going to get beat. One game, they would get beat from the short corner. Another game, they'd get beat on skip passes for threes. Another game, they'd get beat on high-low. And if we would have rewound a few weeks ago, it was a team's going to have to hit a bunch of dribble in mid-range twos in order to beat us. We know exactly how we're going to win and exactly how we're going to lose. Instead of going in the game saying, well, I wonder what's going to give us trouble today. So that's why we love the lock left is, like you said, it's probably the most honest defense as far as what we take away and what we give up. And but no matter what you run, that's a great exercise for coaches too at this time of the year as they head into their season.
Yeah. Okay, let me share another piece sparked by this question. We've already shared the game of the week mark with the game sandwich, I think, example. So I think we are fine there. And then maybe you send us out of here with a reminder of how we can actually teach this better. So let me go first on lock left here. When selecting your defense, regardless of the defense that you select, three reminders, actually three common blind spots that I would remind you as coaches to be aware of when selecting your defense. One common blind spot is too many coaches select their defense in isolation. And what I mean in isolation is without connecting it to what you're trying to do offensively. One thing that I think we do a really good job here at Savvy is we teach both sides of the basketball together at the same time. And I think that that is an eye-opening opportunity for so many coaches, is that everything is two-sided. And when you select your defense, it should also complement what the style of play that you're trying to execute offensively. So don't select your defense isolation. I like this offense for these five reasons. And I like this defense for these opposite five reasons. It should connect. If you're trying to get it on offense, you're trying to take it away on defense, right? If you're trying to give it, if you're trying to not do it on offense, you should be trying to force it on defense. So it's got to be connected. You can't just choose these things in isolation because then you won't improve as a program or your basketball players won't improve. That's one. Don't select in isolation. Second, it doesn't address shot selection. So too many defense focus just on taking away areas of the floor or where we want to funnel or force the basketball, but it doesn't have any clarity on what type of shots we're taking away and what type of shots we're going to allow. So ensure that your defense is focused on shot generation, what type of shots you're trying to generate, and not just areas of the floor. Okay, here's the last one. Most defenses only focus on how you defend neutral or how you defend advantage, offensive advantage, right? Ensure that you select a defense that's going to answer your question of how do we guard neutral, which would result in actions, and how do we guard disadvantage. And I think that most coaches select their defense only by how they're going to guard neutral, but not how they're going to guard actions, right? So like, where do we stand when we're in neutral? Like, where is our help side? Right. So I would say focus more on actions and less on neutral. Here's where I want us to stand when we're neutral. I want our formation to be in this nice 2-3 when the ball is at the top of the key and neutral. No, focus more on what's that defense do when they actually run the action, because you're going to have to try to neutralize an action, not neutralize just the ball being held still at some point on the floor. So I think those are three considerations when determining your defense.
Yeah, really good. Here's how I've always thought of teaching defense. So you mentioned two-way teaching or not in isolation, addressing shot selection as far as what shots we're going to allow or force our opponent into, and then focus on defending actions. If we're coming and we're installing lock left or any type of defense as a coach, one, I would design my defense from the basket out or from the shots that you're wanting to allow or force your opponent into, and then work your way out from the basket as far as how we're designing our defense. So we want to force shots from our spots, which would be on the left side, outside the paint, let's say. Okay, well then how should we guard? What's our wall defender going to do? What's our defender's one pass away going to do? And then how does our defender on the ball play? Design your defense from the basket out, but implement from the perimeter in. So I would start with first, how do we guard the ball? Then how do we guard one pass away? Then how do we guard the rim? Or what's our positioning based in our responsibilities in those three spots? To me, those are like your base, your fundamentals of your defense. You've got ball, you've got one pass away, you've got two or more passes away. That's how you're going to take away nines, sevens, no matter what your opponent runs. And then we take away the stuff they like, which are the actions. For me, I have found it the easiest way to neutralize all actions would be to switch, because of the first point that you made. Offense and defense should complement each other by really being the inverse of each other. It's the paradox of offense and defense. What we value on offense, we value the opposite on defense. On offense, we run race in space, drive in space, whatever you run. You're trying to get two defenders on the ball. And I think the easiest way to do that is to drive the ball in. If we drive the ball in, we draw two. Now we're in dominoes. Defense is at disadvantage. So the goal of defense should be to keep one defender on the ball. How do we do that? It could be switching off ball to keep us out of coverage, or scram switching on the ball to keep one defender on the ball. And that would go into defending actions and then into your disadvantage.
That's a great connection. You said something that I just want to comment on, and I apologize in advance because it would open a whole other can of worms. You think the easiest way to get two players on the ball is by driving it. Don't qualify it. You said it. I actually am going to disagree with that. I would agree to say, I think that's the best way to get two defenders on the ball for most teams. I actually think the easiest way to get two defenders on the ball.
I know. Okay, go ahead. All right. I'm just going to say this. The easiest action to run to get two defenders on the ball is the ball screen. That is why it's the most popular action in basketball. Is that where you're going?
I was going to give three. Okay. As far as the easiest, ball screen one. Post up two. Now that one's, I think post up is actually one. I think post up is the easiest way to get two defenders on the ball if you've got a post that's going to get doubled, because I think it's easier to enter the ball to a dominant post player. It's like, it's actually easier than to drive. But And so like people think I'm like this anti-post guy. Every coach would say, well, Tyler hates post-ups. No, I love post-ups. I just hate most post players. So like you probably don't have someone that's going to demand a double team. So I'd say that's easy. If you've got a dominant post player, you design your entire offense around them. And they touch the ball every single time because it's the easiest way to get two players on the ball. Second is ball screen. Easiest way to get two players on the ball. Unfortunately, most players suck at ball screen reads. And so that's another reason why not to do it. Third one, playing against a trapping defense is the easiest way to get two players on the ball, which is why we love a trapping defense. So anyway, I had to go in on that one because I agree, but also disagree.
Yeah, no. I really like that. And I always ask, this is a great way to lead with questions with your team, is ask them those questions. Like, why would we throw the ball in the post? Well, because then we're going to demand a double team because Tyler's really good in the post. Okay, great. You know, but I'll also add this. The trapping piece. I used to love when teams trapped us because we were automatically playing in dominoes. But also, we get a lot of questions about zone offense. I find it's really easy to get two defenders on you against the zone by driving the ball. Like if you just crack the shell with the ball, you're likely drawing two.
Without putting any pressure on the rim, without Absolutely. Any fear of a nine. Yes.
Because really, if you think about zone defense, you kind of always have two defenders on you anyway. Your job's really just to engage them more. It's like you're halfway to dominoes if you're against the zone. So a lot of coaches ask about zone offense. That's for another time, but don't overthink it.
I was a junior in college before I understood why we drove the gaps in zones. I mean, I went through my entire high school career and drive the gaps. Yes, coach, I'll drive the gaps. I had no idea why we're driving the gaps. No idea, right? And I was a junior in college until I was doing a film breakdown with our point guard specific coach. And he's like, Tyler, he's like, you do a great job of driving gaps. I'm like, yeah, my high school coach really hammered it into me. And he's like, but you're not seeing the openings. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, do you know why we drive gaps? I'm like, yeah, because against zone, you drive gaps. I'm a junior in college and I had no coach had ever told me why. And I was like, it was an epiphany. It's like, oh my gosh, wow, look at this. Don't steal that from your players, coaches. Tell them why when you tell them to do things. Don't steal it from your players. Start with why. That's your teach better segment for the hours, is teach them why they drive the gaps, not just to drive gaps or whatever the heck you're teaching them to do.
All right, coaches, thank you for spending this time with us. If there is something that you have to learn every year as a coach, reach out and let us know.
Join our community. And until then, stay savvy.
Stay savvy.